This is a message by Mark Durie, a vicar of Oak Tree Anglican Church in Caulfield and Elstonwick. It's a message that I gave on a Sunday morning at church, and I've revised it to make it available more widely through the internet through our site. It's on marriage. It's a message on marriage and homosexual marriage. The push for marriage equality, as it's now called by many, has become a significant human rights agenda for many in the West. Ireland's vote for constitutional amendment of the marriage laws and the US Supreme Court's recent rulings are the latest advances of this global campaign. But what should Christians think about this? And if, as many are saying, the change is inevitable, how will it affect us as Christians, or indeed as a church? I was preaching when I spoke about this in church on the biblical passage from Matthew 19, which, although it is about divorce rather than marriage as such, it does cite a key verse from Genesis. Jesus cites the verse, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." This verse, also cited by Paul in his letter to the Ephesians, reflects, I believe, a biblical understanding of marriage as a voluntary, exclusive union of a man and a woman for life. This biblical understanding has influenced Australia's marriage laws, which currently state that marriage means the union of a man and a woman to the exclusion of all others, voluntarily entered into for life. Now, this definition of marriage has four key elements. Firstly, a man and a woman. Secondly, it's voluntary. Thirdly, to the exclusion of others. And fourth, for life. The question is, should this definition be changed? To answer the question, we need to ask, why does the state regulate for marriage at all? What business does the state have to be involved in marriage? And I think it's absolutely clear that the state really has no business making laws for love, for saying who you can and can't love, or using laws even to validate one kind of love over another. But it does regulate sex, and so it should, I think, because of human vulnerability. There are age of consent laws, which were introduced in the 19th century in England, in Victorian England, to suppress sex trafficking, particularly the trafficking of young girls. There are incest laws, and there are laws against sexual assault. All these laws exist for good reasons, but why regulate marriage? Well, to understand this, we need to have some historical awareness, and the explanation does involve the church. Regulation of marriage by a state or even by the church is relatively recent. 1,000 years ago in Europe, it wasn't regulated by the state, it was a social practice. As Europe became Christian, increasingly people became married in churches. So churches became an important way of coordinating and even of controlling the way marriage worked. In the 12th century, Pope Alexander II decreed that marriage should be by the free consent of two spouses and not by a decision of guardians or parents. This was the origin of the provision which still exists in Australian marriage laws, which state that marriage is voluntary. In the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215 and the Council of Trent in 1545-63, there were introduced further regulations which affected the way churches conducted marriages. The regulations included marriages had to be announced in advance in a church by the priest so that if there were legitimate impediments to marriage, for example, the man had already been married before, they could be made known. And bans, an announcement of the wedding, had to be published during three major public worship services beforehand. Weddings had to be conducted by the parish priest in one of the two parties' local church, that is, in their own community. There had to be at least two witnesses to the ceremony, apart from the priest, and clergy had to keep a marriage register in which they recorded every wedding they performed. Now, these aspects of church law were designed to prevent what were called clandestine or secret marriages. These were improperly registered unions, which later could be all too easily denied, disavowed, particularly by the man, and often men did enter into secret marriages and later say that they'd never been married at all, and maybe abandoning their supposed wife and the children to their own devices. The Council of Trent, in fact, explicitly justified these provisions by citing the case of a man who, having conducted a private marriage, a clandestine marriage as they called it, then abandoned his first wife, publicly disowned her, saying he'd never been married to her, and married another woman publicly. And so it was the children of the second marriage that got to enjoy his inheritance, for example. State regulation of marriage was introduced into English law in the Marriage Act of 1753, which was revealingly called an Act for the Better Preventing of Clandestine Marriages. Now, this act enshrined the church's approach right into English law and made it universal throughout England. Previously, there'd been some areas, for example, around the prisons, the so-called Fleet Street, where it was possible to have marriages done secretly without them being properly registered in a parish church. So this act was intended to prevent Fleet Street marriages. And the purpose of this law was to protect vulnerable women and their children from unscrupulous men. Secret, clandestine marriages could be too easily disavowed. The law was influenced by notorious cases such as Creswell versus Creswell in 1748, in which a wealthy heiress, Anne Warneford, discovered that her husband had been clandestinely married twice before, which rendered her public marriage to Thomas Creswell void, and their several children illegitimate, with no entitlement to their father's estate. In fact, it was really quite a kerfuffle. Anne Warneford thought she was married, and then a woman turned up and said, "No, I was married before." And then another woman came and said, "No, I was married before. So neither of you are her true wife, his true wife." Under the 1753 Act, a minister of religion who conducted a clandestine unregistered marriage, or not properly registered marriage, was punishable by transportation to some of His Majesty's plantations in America for the space of 14 years. And there were clergy that were transported for doing clandestine marriages after the Act was brought in. If a priest forged, altered, or destroyed a marriage register, this was a hanging offence. So the state was absolutely determined to ensure that marriages were properly registered. And that's actually where we got our marriage laws from. The English legal tradition regulated marriage essentially by making the rules of the Church of England, the English Church, which they'd inherited from the Catholic Church, into the law of the land. Now, the state got into the marriage regulation business primarily to ensure that vulnerable women, that is, mothers and their children, could be protected from unscrupulous men who were exploiting marriage. Feminists have argued otherwise. They've said that the institution of marriage is a mechanism for the domination and exploitation of women by patriarchy. However, as pernicious as patriarchy can be, I think the evidence of history is not the case, not that. Marriage can be used for abusive purposes, but the state didn't actually get involved in the marriage business to uphold patriarchy. It was regulated to protect vulnerable women and their children. That was the intention of the church councils that introduced the regulation. It was the intention of the English Parliament, which backed it up with the law of the land. Today in Australia, many of the rules introduced by the church in the Middle Ages remain in force, required by the state. A couple must, for example, formally announce their intention of marrying at least 1 month in advance. There must be two witnesses at a wedding. The couple must provide proof of their identity, and weddings must be registered with the state. It's certainly true that society has privileged marriage, giving it a high esteem, and that's only because of the value of its protective character and the importance of cross-generational kinship communities, of what we call families, as the fundamental building block of society for many different purposes. Now, some societies have despised marriage. They've ignored its purposes and have had to relearn the lesson of the value of marriage through very bitter and painful experience. I hope we don't have to have that kind of experience. In post-revolutionary Russia, communists wanted to give marriage a good shake-up. They regarded marriage as an institution that was fundamentally against their progressive vision of a future utopia. So they removed all restrictions on divorce, on abortion, on remarriage. They abolished all distinctions between legitimate and illegitimate children. This turned out to be, in practice, a disaster. By the 1920s, the nation had vast numbers of homeless children, or bezprizhyornye, as they're called, untended ones, who turned to crime, delinquency, drugs, and prostitution in their millions. For a while, the percentage of these bezprizhyornye, these untended children, was about 5% of the total Russian population. The grim outcome of this vast social experiment was reported in The Atlantic in 1926. By that time, an official proposal to finally eliminate the distinction between marriage and cohabitation altogether was met with unexpected opposition from ordinary citizens all over the country who were appalled at the consequences of the breakdown of marriage. Later, the Soviet authorities reversed some of their family policies to address the catastrophic breakdown of the family. They introduced laws, for example, to discourage divorce and make it more difficult. There's no doubt that marriage, understood as the voluntary, exclusive union of a man and a woman for life, is under pressure. For the first 60 years of the 20th century, the percentage of children born outside of marriage in Australia was stable at around 5 to 6%. Now it's over 34%. In the UK, the percentage is nudging 50%. In addition to this, in the UK, almost 45% of children experience the breakdown of their parents' relationship before they reach the age of 16. This is expected to rise to 50% in the coming years. While marriage is weakening in practice, it's also being redefined in law. Instead of being a structure backed and enforced by the state to protect mothers and children from desertion by unscrupulous father-husbands, it's being turned into a technique for promoting sexual choice equality, and the redefinition of marriage has become a measure of how tolerant a society is. Redefining marriage has become a method of demonstrating the equality of homosexuality and of undoing the grip of heteronormativity on mainstream culture. However, the state did not get involved in marriage in the first place to validate love or even to validate heterosexual love. That's not actually what marriage is for. If marriage laws change, it should be a matter of concern that the separation of marriage from its traditional purpose will have far-reaching social consequences. Because same-sex marriage has become a human rights issue, those who oppose the agenda have become human rights abusers, so-called, akin to racists. Experience has shown in other jurisdictions in the West that rejecters of same-sex marriage will be punished by the full force of the state. There are many legal cases around the Western world where Christians and Christian organisations have faced legal action for not supporting same-sex marriage and its various implications. There are the service providers, the bakers of cakes for weddings, who've had to go out of business or be forced to bake their cakes for same-sex marriages. Counsellors have lost their jobs because they've had issues, conscience issues, in counselling same-sex couples about their sexual relationships. Educational institutions have been profoundly affected. Foster parents have been denied the right to be foster parents because they didn't have the politically correct understanding or attitudes towards human sexuality. Adoption agencies have gone out of business in the UK and in the US. Some Christian agencies have gotten out of the adoption business altogether, because it would have meant adopting babies into same-sex relationships without any discrimination. If same-sex marriage is introduced, Christians will also face increasing issues in the public teaching of sexuality and sexual morality in schools. For example, kindergarten readers will celebrate same-sex unions. Sex education classes for primary school children will explain the mechanics of same-sexual activity on the same moral basis as heterosexual activity, and so forth. This is already happening in several Western jurisdictions, and parents have already been required or pressurized to go through re-education if they've objected. It will be a challenge to maintain a distinctive Christian identity in a world which increasingly does not share our values. We are moving into an era in the West where Christians cannot rely on the social capital of the state to reinforce Christian faith and values. On the contrary, we should not be surprised if a secular state undermines and works against Christian faith. We don't want that to happen. We will work against that happening, but we shouldn't be surprised if it does happen. Christians also cannot expect the state to impose specifically Christian rules on non-Christian citizens. Nevertheless, we do have a duty to argue and a responsibility to argue that the laws which the state imposes on its citizens should serve the common good. They should serve the public interest. And I, for one, believe that embracing same-sex marriage will undermine the institution of marriage, an institution which is already in trouble and under threat, under pressure. The state, instead of focusing its energies on supporting marriage, an institution designed to protect and rear children, will be diverted into using this redefined concept of marriage as a platform, as a tool, for an ongoing campaign against heteronormativity pursued in the name of human rights. This will be a very costly distraction for a society which ought to be encouraging men and women to form stable, lifelong relationships and raise their own children together. If same-sex marriage does come to Australia, the Church will need to come to terms with many profound implications of this change. It will become even clearer than it is at present, that a Christian marriage is a completely different thing from a state-registered marriage. Of course, this has already been the case. To take just one example, adultery is not a crime in the eyes of the state, despite the promise of exclusive union in the Marriage Act. And divorce has long been no fault in this country. This means, in effect, that to the exclusion of all others clause in Australian marriage laws have no force at all in secular law, except perhaps in the area of property rights. However, most churches will continue to insist that adultery is against Christian teaching, even though the state supports it only nominally. It's essential that churches are very clear about the distinctive character of Christian marriage, and that they are willing to uphold their understanding of marriage, even in the face of persecution, even as the state's understanding diverges farther from the Christian understanding of marriage, if that happens. C.S. Lewis, writing about the subject of divorce, captured this very well. He argued that the church doesn't have a business on insisting that the state make divorce illegal for everyone, just because the Bible forbids it. He wrote, "There ought to be two distinct kinds of marriage, one governed by the state with rules enforced on all citizens, and the other governed by the church with rules enforced by her on her own members. The distinction ought to be quite sharp so that a man knows which couples are married in a Christian sense and which are not." In the past, the state's concept of marriage has been close to that of the church. Indeed, it was built upon it. For a long time in England, it was the same concept. However, for quite some time, there's been a growing divergence between the two, in practice and now also increasingly in theory in the West. Same-sex homosexual marriage will make this divergence even clearer by enshrining it in law. This would force a divorce between the state marriage contract and a Christian understanding of marriage. This will be a significant landmark in a developing divergence, a parting of the ways of church and state. In a society which upholds same-sex marriage, the church-state partnership will need to be rethought and reworked. The majority of Christians will not renounce heteronormativity as a theological principle. Those Western churches who are embracing homosexual unions are, the fact is, generally from denominations which are declining the most rapidly. They do not represent the future of Christianity. The shift towards acceptance of homosexual unions is not one that will be the future of the church, whether in the West or in the rest of the world. If Christian marriage then is quite different from state registered partnering, it could become incongruous for clergy to be marriage celebrants at all on behalf of the state, with the power to register marriages. As the state's definition of marriage diverges from that of the church, the continental model will seem more natural, in which couples register their relationship, if they wish to, at the registry office, and then have their unions blessed in a church, if they wish to consider to be married in the sight of God. In recent days, I've even heard of some members of the public questioning why Christians should register their marriages with the state at all if the state changes the definition of marriage. Wouldn't a church marriage be sufficient and even superior to the state's registration? Australian law has already removed so many forms of discrimination against couples who are not married in the eyes of the state. So some are asking, why wouldn't being married in the eyes of God be enough anyway? Many Muslims have already gone down this track. Polygamy is widely practiced by Muslims in Australia, not registered with the state, of course, without the state apparently showing any concern about it. the divergence between religious marriage and state marriage would only increase if same-sex marriage goes ahead. Questions like this would have been unthinkable even a decade ago. To suggest, for example, that Christians, in getting married, shouldn't register their marriage with the state would have been really quite unthinkable. And these questions don't augur well, the fact that they are arising already, that it doesn't augur well for the stability or even the relevance and usefulness of state-registered marriages, nor does it speak well of the state's capacity to shape marriage and the way families are formed. It should be a warning to us also that there are definitely some gay pride activists who are far from content with just degendering marriage. Simon Copeland, writing on the SBS website, has argued that once same-sex marriage has been granted, the next great battle is to further dismantle marriage, and particularly its principle of monogamy, which he says exists to oppress women through economic domination. He writes, "For years now, the more promiscuous in the queer community have been told that gays and lesbians need to access marriage so we can queer it up. The best way to break down these traditions, we've been told, is from the inside. But is that really true? Many marriage equality campaigns have reinforced these conservative traditions." He writes, "We've seen inspirational campaign videos eschewing, I think he means supporting, the linear monogamous tale of marriage, arguments that same-sex marriages are important for the well-being of children, and activists who have actively rejected the possibility of legal rights for polyamorous relationships in the future." Copeland finds these trends amongst the homosexual community appalling. "The next great battle," he argues, "which gays and heteros," he says, "will partner in to bring about together, is the removal of exclusive monogamy from the definition of marriage altogether." He's saying polyamory will be the next phase in the deconstruction of marriage. Christians do have a duty to promote biblical values in the public square, what Wilberforce called the Reformation of Manners. Many of us in the church will continue to argue that a traditional understanding of marriage is good for children, it's good for families, it's good for society, and for this reason, it's good for us all, and it should be promoted quite irrespective of people's religious beliefs. At the same time, we also need to keep in mind that our faith, Christ's kingdom, is not of this world, and we're warned to expect even persecution in this life, and certainly not perfect agreement between church and state. Christians also need to be increasingly aware of the need to make radical choices about how we do life in the face of the pressures of a secular world. Marriage is just one of many issues facing Christians. Others which come to mind are something as mundane as Sunday sport, or related to the same-sex marriage issue, the queering up of education, the sexualization and even pornification of childhood. And how are we to form Christian community in an increasingly secularized world? Things are not going to get easier for Christians as we seek to let our light shine in the world. The centuries-long partnership of state and church is being threatened. It is seemingly unraveling. It is, of course, far from dead yet, and Christians are not going to let it fall away without a fight. We may even be able to hang on to heteronormative marriage and stem the tide in Australia. I hope we do. But it's reasonable to consider what the future may bring if we don't. The longer-term outcome of these changes could well be that state marriage, that is, the marriage contract under law, will bear an increasingly distant relationship to the actual marriage practices of citizens. State-registered unions will become less relevant and less effective in advancing the common good. Now, there are good reasons in the social interest for a traditional model of marriage as an exclusive, voluntary, lifelong union of a man and a woman, and there are good reasons for this to be held up by the state. The primary function of this regulated, privileged arrangement was always to protect vulnerable women and children from abandonment by their male partners, the criticism of the feminists notwithstanding. At the same time, if the church does not succeed in persuading society and government to uphold marriage understood in this way, Christians need to be very clear about standing up for their own understanding of marriage and emphasizing that a Christian marriage is a distinct and different thing from a state marriage. This will mean, on the one hand, stepping back from the state's conception of marriage, in a sense giving it less support, and on the other hand, further strengthening and emphasizing Christian marriage as a distinct arrangement from that offered by the state.